From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! One man ran a prison system in Utah, where a schizophrenic man died after he was stripped naked, strapped to a restraining chair for 16 hours. Another man ran the system in Arizona, where 14 women were raped, sodomized, or assaulted by prison guards. Another ran Connecticut's prison system, where at least two people died after being severely beaten. All of the men were forced out of these prison systems by lawsuits or political controversy. But rather than being sent to prison themselves, the U.S. government sent them to Iraq to set up one prison, Abu Ghraib. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in San Francisco has ruled that a new ban on late-term abortions is unconstitutional because it jeopardizes a woman's right to choose and because it could threaten the health of women who seek to end their pregnancies. The ruling was a major setback for the Bush administration and opponents of abortion who've expressed hope that the bill, officially known as the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, would become the first step toward making all abortion illegal. Planned Parenthood brought the suit against the Justice Department. The group's president, Gloria Felt, said Tuesday, quote, "Today's ruling is a landmark victory for medical privacy rights and women's health. The Ashcroft Department of Justice can no longer threaten Planned Parenthood doctors with the daunting specter of criminal prosecution for putting their patients first." The judge accused Congress of being grossly misleading and inaccurate when it referred to the banned procedure, which is known in the medical world as intact dilation and extraction, as infanticide. President Bush's reelection campaign issued a statement describing the judge's decision as a, quote, tragic ruling. The Bush administration defended the makeup of the newly selected Iraqi interim government, even though it will be led by members of the Iraqi Governing Council, which was widely seen as illegitimate by the Iraqi people. One former leading member of the council, Mahmoud Othman, protested the actions of U.S. occupation head Paul Bremer and the U.N. envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, in shaping the new government. Othman told The Guardian, quote, "The behavior of Mr. Bremer and Mr. Brahimi has been shameful. It's like being in a dictatorship again," he said. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice defended the makeup of the government, saying, quote, "Look, these are not America's puppets." The interim prime minister, president, deputy president, and one of the ministers of state were all members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council, which dissolved itself Tuesday to allow the interim government to take power. Agence France-Presse reported the new prime minister, Iyad Alawi, a former Baathist with ties to the CIA and Saudi intelligence, went out of his way to call for U.S. forces to stay in Iraq. He said, quote, "I call on the United States and Europe to protect Iraq." A New York Times editorial today reads, quote, "The end of the Governing Council concludes a chapter of unpopular, ineffectual governance that failed to stem a growing insurgency and did little to lay the groundwork for a workable democracy. The new governing body looks uncomfortably like the old one with a new name and a few added powers," it said. It still remains unclear what power the interim government will have, even though the U.S. claims it will have full sovereignty. A revised UN resolution put forward by the United States yesterday would allow Iraq to oversee its own military and police forces, but 140,000 U.S. troops would remain and have the power to act at will. The resolution, however, does appear to set a 2006 deadline for the departure of the U.S. and other foreign troops from Iraq. China, France, Russia, and other nations expressed disappointment with the new resolution's failure to give the Iraqi government true sovereignty. The interim government will not have the power to make laws or revoke any laws instituted by the U.S. occupying forces. It's not clear what will happen after June 30th to the thousands of Iraqis who are currently being detained, many of whom have never been charged with a crime. U.S. soldiers and contractors will likely remain immune from criminal prosecution and liability in Iraq. Meanwhile, under current rules, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, and the Arab Development Bank will supervise an advisory and monitoring board that'll keep tabs on Iraq's revenues and expenditures. And up to 160 U.S. advisors will continue working in the newly formed Iraqi ministries. One U.N. diplomat said, quote, "It's a charade. The problem is that you need a charade to get to the reality of an elected government next January. There's no other way to do this," he said. The New York Times is reporting the U.S.-backed Iraqi exile leader Ahmed Chalabi disclosed to an Iranian official one of Washington's mostly guarded secrets about Iran, that it had broken Iran's top-secret communications code, allowing the U.S. to easily spy on Iran's intelligence service. According to the Times, the breaking of Iran's code was so important that the Bush administration requested, on national security grounds, that the New York Times and other newspapers not report on the story. The Times said it agreed to the order. It is not clear how long the Times knew about the charge before it published its article today. The order not to publish was rescinded by the government on Tuesday as information about the code breaking began to leak out to the press. American officials said about 6 weeks ago, Chalabi told the Baghdad station chief of Iran's spy service that the U.S. was reading its communications traffic. According to officials, the Iranian station chief then sent a cable to Tehran detailing the conversation using the code. The U.S. intercepted and read the cable. The FBI soon opened an espionage investigation to determine who told Chalabi that the Iranian code was broken. The Justice Department launched a campaign Tuesday to defend its detainment of Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant. The Brooklyn-born Padilla has been held in solitary confinement for 2 years. No charges have been filed against him. He's never appeared in court and has had almost no contact with his lawyer. In a few weeks, the Supreme Court will rule on his detention. But yesterday, the Justice Department attempted to win its case in the court of public opinion by declassifying documents that allege Padilla received training and orders from Al-Qaeda to build a dirty bomb and to blow up hotels and apartment building. Michael Greenberger, University of Maryland law professor who has followed the Padilla case, said he believes the government is trying to influence Supreme Court justices who are now weighing Padilla's challenge to his enemy combatant status. Greenberger said, quote, "I'm sorry to say I come away with no other conclusion that it was designed to have some kind of extrajudicial influence on the Supreme Court decision." The Washington Post reports President Bush has run one of the most negative advertising presidential campaigns in U.S. history. According to calculations based on the top 100 TV markets, Bush has aired 49,000 negative ads, or about 75% of his total. Senator John Kerry, meanwhile, has just run over 13,000 negative ads, or about 27% of his total. In other election news, Democrat Stephanie Herseth has won a special election in South Dakota to fill the seat of Republican Bill Janklow, who stepped down after being convicted in a fatal car accident. It marked the second special election in a row that the Democrats picked up a House seat. The party needs to gain 11 seats in November to gain a majority of the House. And it was announced Tuesday that Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, will open in theaters on June 25th. Last month, news broke that Disney was refusing to distribute the film, which is highly critical of the Bush administration. But Disney sold the film's rights to Harvey and Bob Weinstein, who will personally help distribute the film in partnership with Lionsgate Films and IFC Films. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 200 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. This is the largest public media collaboration in the country. I'm Amy Goodman. One man ran a prison system in Utah where a 29-year-old schizophrenic died after he was stripped naked and strapped to a restraining chair for 16 hours. Another man ran the system in Arizona where 14 women were raped, sodomized, or assaulted by prison guards. Another ran Connecticut's prison system where at least two people died after being severely beaten. All of the men who ran these prison systems were forced out by lawsuits or political controversy. But rather than being sent to prison themselves, the U.S. government sent them to Iraq to set up the prisons there. Actually, one prison, Abu Ghraib. In the weeks since the torture scandal at Abu Ghraib grabbed international headlines, the Bush administration and the Pentagon have attempted to put forth a consistent story that the abuses were the work of individual soldiers acting on their own and that there was no systematic program of abuse at the prison. However, over the past few weeks, this version of events has been shot down by veteran correspondent Cy Hirsch of the New Yorker magazine. Contrary to the administration's claims, Hirsch revealed that the torture at the Abu Ghraib prison was part of a Pentagon-approved black ops operation authorized by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to look extensively at the four-man team of correctional advisors dispatched by the U.S. government to Iraq shortly after the occupation began. Their job was to get the notorious Abu Ghraib prison up and running by the U.S. occupation forces. For people or governments concerned with human rights, their resumes and records read like warning labels for who not to have running a prison, especially in a country where the U.S. claims to be building democracy. The four men are Lane McCotter, former director of the Utah Department of Corrections, and John Armstrong, former director of the Connecticut DOC, Terry Stewart, former director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, and his top deputy, Chuck Ryan. Today, we'll speak with people in a number of these different states, but we'll begin with Dan Frosch, an independent reporter based in New York City. His most recent articles published in The Nation magazine and on Alternet look at the role of a number of the former officials at the U.S. prisons who were sent to Iraq to set up the Abu Ghraib prison. The Nation piece this month is called Exporting America's Prison Problems. Dan, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
Can you start off by giving us an overview of this group of advisors that were sent to set up Abu Ghraib?
Sure. There were actually two teams of advisors, as far as I know. The first team being sent last May and containing Mr. McCotter and also a guy by the name of Gary DeLand, who was McCotter's predecessor in Utah, and Terry Stewart, who, as you mentioned, was the head of the Department of Corrections in Arizona. They were charged with the mission of reconstructing the Iraqi prison system, which, of course, included working at Abu Ghraib, and also they were charged with a mission of training a Iraqi corrections force. It's not precisely clear what exactly they were doing while they were over there, in large part because the Justice Department has been pretty much tight-lipped since news reports have surfaced containing their collective resumes and records, which, of course, are fairly disturbing. Once McCotter and Stewart left after about 4 months in Iraq, another team was sent, and this team contained John Armstrong, who of course was the head of the DOC in Connecticut, and also Terry Stewart's top deputy, Chuck Ryan, presumably, again, we don't know because the Justice Department isn't really commenting on this. Presumably, Ryan and Armstrong were charged with the same mission, continuing the work of McCotter and Stewart, and that to quote unquote reconstruct the Iraqi prison system. I think what's particularly disturbing about this whole situation is that the track records of McCotter, Stewart, and Armstrong are well publicized, well known, well reported. The records aren't big secrets, so that leads one to believe that either A, the Justice Department hired them in what was really a horrendous oversight, B, they couldn't find anybody else to go, or C, and really the kind of the most ominous option is that the Justice Department actually sought out people who they perceived as tough and hard-nosed correction types, who could, who they thought could get the job done, in a place like Iraq, which presumably was a very difficult environment to work in terms of corrections.
Well, let's start off by looking at Lane McCotter.
Sure.
Lane McCotter, who began in the 80s running the Fort Leavenworth prison, which is next to the Leavenworth prison, at the same time that Colin Powell was deputy commander of Fort Leavenworth. He then went to Utah. Can you talk about, I mean, he had did some other things in between, but can you talk about his time in Utah?
Yes. Certainly he was at best controversial in Utah. He was the subject of a number of different lawsuits regarding the abuse of inmates in the Utah Department of Corrections. The most well-known was the case in 1997 of a schizophrenic inmate named Michael Valent, who was restrained in a device called the chair. After refusing to take a pillowcase off his head, he was restrained in a device called a chair for about 16 hours. And upon being released from the chair, 2 hours later, he died after a blood clot had formed in his leg and moved up his body. McCotter and his administration, according to the sources that I have in Utah, defended the use of the chair, and initially actually tried to say that and had been banging his head against the wall, and then later on retracted that statement when it came out there was a videotape of the entire incident. The guy had simply had a pillowcase on his head and wouldn't take it off. That was the most well-known case in Utah. There was also the ACLU at the time had been gathering evidence and deposing inmates.
Hello.
Regarding the use of
I can't hear anything.
A board, in which it may
we're talking to Dan Frosch. I just wanted to clarify for the guest who is about to come on, Dan Frosch describing what is taking place. Go ahead, Dan Frosch, in Utah.
Yes, I was saying that the ACLU had also been working on a legal action regarding the use of another device called the board. In which inmates were strapped to a stainless steel board and left there. One inmate in particular was left there for weeks on end and actually successfully sued McCotter and the Utah DOC for the use of the board. So this was a guy who had certainly racked up a controversial reputation in Utah, a disturbing reputation, and these were widely known controversies all over the newspapers, and eventually after the incident regarding Michael Valent, McCotter was forced to step down.
We're talking to Dan Frosch, who has written a number of reports on the group of advisors that the Justice Department sent to set up the Abu Ghraib prison. When we come back, we're going to speak with the mayor of Salt Lake City in Utah. Stay with us. Thank you.
سلام على دار السلام جزيل وعتبى على أن العتاب طويل أبغداد لا أهوى سواك مدينة وما لي عن أم العراق بديل بغداد لا أهوى سواك مدينة وما لي عن أم العراق وما لي عن أم العراق
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take a look at the group of advisors who were sent by the Justice Department to Iraq to set up the Abu Ghraib prison, we're looking at one who headed the Utah prison system, and where a 29-year-old schizophrenic man died after he was strapped naked to a restraining chair for 16 hours. Another of the men running the system in Arizona, where 14 women were raped, sodomized, or assaulted by prison guards. Another running Connecticut's prison system, where at least two people died after being severely beaten. We turn now to Mayor Rocky Anderson, mayor of Salt Lake City. He was the lead counsel in a 1997 lawsuit brought by Angie Armstrong, the mother of Michael Valente. She sued the state of Utah after her son died in custody. Can you tell us about this case and about Lane McCotter, who headed the Utah system and was recently sent to Iraq?
Yes. Actually, Lane McCotter followed Gary DeLand as executive director, and they're now partners, and both of them were sent over as advisors to the United States government to help set up the prison in Iraq. Lane, when he was the executive director, oversaw a prison that I think was had very, very serious human rights abuses taking place, and without any real effort to resolve them. And in Michael Valente's case, he was a young schizophrenic young man. And by the way, many of the worst human rights abuses I think took place with regard to mentally ill inmates. Michael had been doing very well when he was held at the Utah State Hospital, when he was medicated properly, when he had good psychiatric treatment. But once he entered the Utah State Prison, he started deteriorating rapidly. He went a number of days without having any medications. They didn't force medicate him as they could have done. And the guards, when they came up to his cell, he was unresponsive to them. He'd been unresponsive, actually, for a number of days, but this time he had a pillowcase over his head, probably trying to keep out the voices that he heard. And when Michael would not remove the pillowcase, continued to be unresponsive to prison personnel, instead of providing some treatment, instead of providing any sort of compassionate professional help for Michael. Instead, they called in the SWAT team, who came in forcibly, threw Michael to the floor, took him out and outside of his cell. Now, by that time, he'd wrapped himself up into some blankets. They cut the blankets and his clothing off with scissors, leaving him stark naked, had him shackled, handcuffed, marched him down to a restraint chair where they tied his wrists down, they tied his ankles back. This is all videotape, by the way. This isn't just somebody's account of this. It's all on videotape. You could see them on the video pull the strap on his ankles back as far as they could, and he was held there for 16 hours without ever being examined by the psychiatrist that ordered him into the chair. After he was finally released, after the 16 hours, he was taken down to the shower where he collapsed, and he ultimately died having suffered from blood clotting during the 16 hours he was in the chair, and he threw a pulmonary embolus. This turns out not to have been a rare instance at all. We obtained affidavits of a number of inmates, many of them suffering from mental illness, who were subjected to restraint in the chair, some of them for a number of days, and also other inmates who were strapped down on a metal board, they called it the board, four-pointed with their wrists and their ankles tied down, some of them for a number of days also. In most of these instances that were reported to us, the inmates were held completely naked and left either sitting or lying in their own feces and urine.
We're talking to Mayor Rocky Anderson. What knowledge did Lane McCotter have of this, head of the Utah Department of Corrections?
Well, he not only knew of the use of the restraint chair and the board, but he defended their use. I'm getting a lot of distortion. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, and okay. You're very clear.
All right.
And so what happened next? You brought a lawsuit against Lane McCotter. Were there other lawsuits?
Yes, I brought a lawsuit on behalf of Eric Edwards, who experienced some horrendous treatment at the hands of prison personnel. In fact, Eric called me one evening. He didn't have anybody at the prison, apparently, that he could confide in or that showed any sort of compassionate treatment at all. He had he would slash his arms or his eyelids, his tongue with a razor blade, obviously suffering from mental illness, be taken to the hospital, treated there, and then brought back to the prison instead of seeing a counselor or any medical personnel. He would be strapped onto the board and left there to suffer further, again, lying there naked. Lane McCotter's response in the chair case was that the chair was a useful device to restrain inmates when they were going to hurt themselves or hurt others, and I think it really became clear that they were using the restraint chair simply as a substitute for any kind of appropriate medical or psychiatric treatment. Michael Valente, his putting his pillowcase over his head was not hurting anybody. There were certainly other means of handling the problem, and the only contact with any medical personnel before he was taken to the restraint chair was when they called a psychiatrist at home, and he very casually ordered that they just go ahead and restrain Michael, and then it wasn't until 16 hours that the psychiatrist, again without ever having seen Michael, ordered that he be taken out of the restraint chair.
We're talking to Mayor Rocky Anderson, mayor of Salt Lake City. Ultimately, Lane McCarter was forced out as head of the Utah Department of Corrections.
Well, he denies that. He says the timing, I guess, was coincidental, but he left Utah Department of Corrections shortly after the resolution of this lawsuit. But like his predecessor, Gary DeLand, who also had some, who has a record of real disdain toward inmates and their rights. And that, by the way, none of this is difficult to find. If the State Department's saying that they didn't know this about these people, all one has to do is do the most casual of legal research to find, for instance, the case of Littlefield versus DeLand, a case out of the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit, where the court describes what I think could be characterized as absolutely medieval treatment of a mentally ill inmate at the Salt Lake County Jail while Gary DeLand was commander of the jail. An inmate held naked without any bedding, without even a blanket, left to lie naked on the concrete floor in his cell for 56 days without ever a hearing and without any medical treatment. So these things are fairly easy to find out about the record of these men, but instead of resigning and going into some other field after this record of civil liberties abuses, human rights abuses, they went into the lucrative field of prison consulting in this country.
Mayor Anderson, when you heard that Lane McCotter had been sent to Iraq, what was your response?
Well, I actually ran into Mr. McCotter in the airport here in Salt Lake City, and he told me he was going over to do that. I guess my response was no different than when I had heard that Mr. DeLand and Mr. McCotter had gone into the private business of consulting with other prisons, and frankly, my personal view has always been that it's hard for me to understand when people have a record of such disdain toward basic human and civil rights of inmates, how it is that they're out making a living, and I understand they fared pretty well financially, consulting in the prison industry. And unfortunately, it's taken the abuse of Iraqi prisoners for much of our nation's media to focus on the abuse of American inmates, and especially the mentally ill.
We're talking to Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who before he was mayor brought lawsuit on behalf of Angie Armstrong, the mother of Michael Vallant, sued the state of Utah after her son died while in custody. So DeLand leaves public corrections, so does McCotter, and they move on to Management and Training, a private Utah-based corrections company, which is hired by Santa Fe, New Mexico system. McCotter is MTC's, that's Management and Training Corporation's, Director of Corrections Business Development. In August 2001, McCotter, once Secretary of Corrections in New Mexico, travels to Santa Fe to finalize MTC's three-year contract to operate the Santa Fe County Detention Center. I'm reading from Dan Frosch's piece. It says, less than a year later, a team of Justice Department correctional experts was inside the Santa Fe jail investigating civil rights violations. In March 2003, their report concludes that certain conditions violated inmates' constitutional rights and that inmates suffered, quote, harm or the risk of serious harm from, among other things, woeful deficiencies in health care and basic living conditions. The report documented numerous and horrifying examples and threatened a lawsuit if things didn't get better. Amid the fallout The Justice Department pulled its approximately 100 federal prisoners out of Santa Fe and MTC, fired its warden, and pressured its medical subcontractor to axe one of its medical administrators. This is the Justice Department that did this report. This is John Ashcroft's Justice Department that then went on to announce that Mr. McCotter, among three other corrections experts, were headed to Iraq. We turn now to Mark Donatelli, Santa Fe, New Mexico-based attorney who specializes in criminal justice issues. Can you talk about what happened in the Santa Fe detention facility at the time that MTC, the Utah-based Corrections Company Management and Training Corporation, was in charge?
Well, there's been a public report released by the Justice Department that documents longstanding abuse. I must say that it was in existence before his company took over, but continued pretty much in the same manner it had before. Reckless disregard for serious medical and mental health needs of prisoners, in some cases resulting in death, suicide, incredible neglect of mental health prisoners once again. And ironically, just a couple of weeks ago, the Justice Department team was back in town reevaluating the prison while these revelations were coming out about McCotter having started this operation in Iraq. So, as Dan pointed out in his article, McCotter was no stranger to the Justice Department. I don't want to fault the Justice Department people who were out here, because they're it's not the wing of the Justice Department that was involved in setting up the Iraq operations. These are people in the Civil Rights Division who were investigating the allegations of civil rights violations, who had documented the involvement of McCotter's company here. Remember, this is not New Mexico's first exposure to McCotter. He was no stranger. He'd come here in the mid-'80s in the wake of our riot, and had acquired quite a reputation here even back then. It was surprising to many of us in Santa Fe that the county would consider doing business with McCotter's company, given the reputation he had in New Mexico from the mid-'80s, that we knew we had problems at our jail. We knew things needed to be turned around, and one would have thought they would understand that McCotter's company was the last place to turn to reform jail operations.
Well, can you talk about the specific record in Santa Fe, why ultimately the Ashcroft Justice Department pulled out 100 federal prisoners from Santa Fe?
Well, I can tell you about both. His reputation from when he ran our entire statewide prison system and when he ran the jail. But in reverse order, when he ran the jail, we had numerous lawsuits filed, particularly by female prisoners who had been abused both by staff and other prisoners. Male prisoners were allowed to go into female living units and sexually assault female prisoners. And on the male side, we had a number of well-documented cases involving denial of medical care, denial of treatment to seriously mentally ill prisoners, and that's why the Justice Department is still considering actually formally filing a lawsuit against Santa Fe County. The report, public documents, long-standing abuses, especially in the area of medical and mental health care, plus problems of physical abuse. But as I said, we also had experience with him in the mid-'80s. He was in charge of our entire state corrections system. Many people may not remember that Mexico had the worst prison riot in the United States history. 33 prisoners were killed in 1980. And that came at the heels of years of physical abuse, overcrowding, just deplorable treatment of mentally ill prisoners. Not on McCotter's watch, but he came in in the aftermath, a few years after the riot, after a federal lawsuit had been filed against the state to reform the entire correction system in New Mexico. And although we had made progress for a few years in correcting conditions, as soon as McCotter came in, he took the position that despite the horrendous history we had in New Mexico of physical abuse and murders, it was nobody's business to come into his prison system and monitor conditions. The federal court was without jurisdiction. There was no reason that the state couldn't be trusted and allowed to run its own prison system. And he filed a countersuit, essentially, challenging the longstanding federal court order that had been in place. We spent 3 years going to the United States Supreme Court. We ultimately prevailed. But during those 3 years, McCotter set us back to almost pre-riot conditions. We had, once again, this atmosphere that he brought from Texas. I mean, his reputation was well-known in Texas before he came here. He was no reformer when he was in Texas. He came here to New Mexico and just, once again, instilled this atmosphere of oppressive, abusive conditions and attitude that spread through the ranks, that guards were not accountable. It didn't matter what happened to prisoners who were in their custody. And our system quickly reverted to the conditions that produced our riot in 1980. And one well-documented incident, on McCotter's watch, they had a massive shakedown and extraction of a prison here in Santa Fe. And they happened to be videotaping all this. And during one of the cell removals, the guards were caught beating a handcuffed prisoner up against a wall, fell to the ground, and the federal court monitor asked for the tape of the extraction, and lo and behold, the portion of the tape where the prisoner was beaten while handcuffed in front of supervisors at the prison, that portion of the tape was erased. Now, no one could ever put McCotter near the videotape machine, but this happened on his watch and was just unheard of at that time in our post-riot period that people would use these sort of what had been known as Texas tactics in running a prison and covering up violations of civil rights. So this was the pattern that we had dealt with in the mid-'80s when McCotter was here, and then the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Department and Commission brought him back in to run our jail. That's the history in New Mexico.
Mark Donatelli, Santa Fe, New Mexico-based attorney, specializes in criminal justice issues. Following one of the worst prison riots in U.S. history in New Mexico in 1980, he was appointed by a federal judge to the Prison Oversight Board, involved with a number of lawsuits involving New Mexico's prisons during the tenure of Lane McCotter. We're going to go to a break. We're going to hear a bit about Mr. McCotter's tenure in Texas, and then we'll go to Connecticut to find out about another of the advisors who was sent to Iraq with Lane McCotter and DeLand. He is the former head of the Department of Corrections in Connecticut. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Thank you. Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Donna Brorby, lead counsel from 91 to 2002, over a decade, a class action suit brought by prisoners in Texas, raising a broad range of constitutional issues around prison conditions. Lane McCotter was the director of the prison system in Texas from 1985 to 1987. He then went on to head up the Department of Corrections in New Mexico, then went on to Utah, and went back to New Mexico, running the Santa Fe detention facility as a private contractor. Donna Brorby, can you take us back to Texas?
You know, I haven't been listening to your show, so I can't follow smoothly, but Lane McCotter was director in Texas for about 18 months. He wasn't a particularly notable figure there. 18 months was a relatively small time within the 1980s when the Texas prisons were going through some tremendous changes. At the time that he took the helm in Texas, violence, including homicidal violence, was at an all-time high in the prison system, partly due to a lack of sufficient staff. That was a problem upon which he didn't make much progress. In the middle of his tenure in 1986, we had a contempt motion raising that issue and other major issues, including lack of medical and mental health care. The prisoners won that motion because of the evidence at the time, but then he'd only been there about 10 months or a year at the time that went to hearing.
And can you talk about Lane McCotter's role then, overall his tenure characterized, though I realize it's only a brief portion of what you dealt with?
He didn't have much positive impact on the prison system. He didn't lead it through changes. He was, you know, a conservative guy, and he had, you know, demonstrated some tendencies towards harshness or punitiveness towards prisoners that, you know, are maybe a little bit notable now, but actually very ordinary. But, for example, new prisons were being built, and there were going to be windows in the cells, which was very common in prisons then and now, and he made an attempt to prevent the windows from being put in cells for segregated prisoners. He expressed some fear that the segregation units would be too comfortable. Segregation units sort of are the sort of units where prisoners who are in trouble with staff are placed, and the fear that they could be, you know, too comfortable indicates a certain kind of attitude about punishment. There had been an agreement entered by the state about the construction of new prisons, and in order to deal with a crowding problem at the time, he tried to violate that agreement, which, you know, we thought showed poor judgment.
We're talking to Donna Brorby, who was lead counsel for a decade in a class action suit brought by prisoners in Texas, raising a broad range of constitutional issues related to prison conditions. Lane McCotter, director in Texas from 85 to 87. It's interesting. Senator Charles Schumer, the New York senator, has written several letters to the attorney general asking questions about Lane McCotter's appointment moving from Texas, Utah, and New Mexico with his record to set up the prison in outside Baghdad, Abu Ghraib. One of his press releases, it says that he revealed that Attorney General John Ashcroft had appointed an individual with a checkered past involving case of prisoner mistreatment as one of the four advisors who oversaw Iraq's prison system. Schumer called on Ashcroft to explain why he appointed Lane McCotter, the former director of Utah's correction system, who was forced out of that position after a 97 case of prisoner mistreatment, to help oversee the Iraqi correction system. He further asked Ashcroft to answer a series of questions regarding the selection process for civilian advisors and contractors and the potential investigation of these individuals' roles in Iraq's prisons. Schumer said, why Attorney General Ashcroft would send someone with a checkered record to rebuild Iraq's correction systems is beyond me. You just don't send someone about whom so many questions have been raised to handle such a sensitive task. It defies logic and reason, and it demands answers. We're going to go now from Texas and from Lane McCotter to another one of the advisors who were sent to Iraq, chosen by the Justice Department. He is John Anderson. Antonio Pomver is with us, a Connecticut-based attorney who represents a number of people who have dealt with this issue. Can you talk about the advisor coming from Connecticut?
Sure. His name is John Armstrong.
John Armstrong, sorry.
And he was the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction from 1995 to 2003. He ended up leaving office and probably would dispute this characterization, but I think it's fair to say that he left office and was forced out of office in the wake of a scandal having to do with the sexual harassment and retaliation against female guards in the prison system. And it was the subject of considerable attention, both in the Connecticut legislature and in some governmental agencies who were investigating the rights, the violation of women's right to equal protection in the prison system. But I have represented inmates and the families of inmates for a number of years here and have sued him and his staff members concerning the death of mentally ill inmates in Connecticut. And probably the most notorious case during Mr. Armstrong's tenure was the death of a young paranoid schizophrenic man named Timothy Perry, who was sent from a state psychiatric hospital to a facility of the Connecticut Department of Correction. He was pre-trial. He hadn't been convicted of any crime. He'd only been in jail for about 12 days when he was killed by guards during a takedown and restraint sort of procedure. And there's a rule in Connecticut that requires the videotaping of any planned use of force. Portions of this videotape were later erased, and so the tape begins, and Mr. Perry has already been killed. And there's about a half a dozen guards placing him into a four-point restraint cell, which is a cell that has a bed with shackles for the inmate's hands and feet. And the guards, notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Perry is already dead, pretend that he's alive, or at least appear on the videotape to be pretending that he's alive. They're using pain compliance techniques against Mr. Perry. One officer says inmate Perry still resisting when his body is completely unresponsive and has been flaccid for many minutes. And a nurse then comes into the cell, and you can see quite clearly on the videotape that she injects Mr. Perry's body with three different kinds of sedatives. The medical examiner in Connecticut, when he did the autopsy, determined that the medication was pooled at the injection site, meaning that Mr. Perry, at the time of the injection, had no circulation and was dead. The significant thing about that case, one obviously significant thing about it is that it's just an absolutely horrific event that is almost too difficult to believe. And were it not for the videotape, I think no one would believe it. But the reason I think this is significant in terms of John Armstrong's tenure here is not because he was involved in the incident. He wasn't. He was the commissioner. He was not even at this facility at the time the event took place. But he, by his own admission and by state statute, is the person ultimately responsible for all command and control decisions at the department and was specifically responsible for ensuring that there be a meaningful investigation of all inmate deaths and that appropriate discipline and remedial measures be taken against all staff members who commit misconduct at the department. His response to the Timothy Perry incident was the demotion of one lieutenant involved in the incident. He was demoted from lieutenant to correctional guard. Three or four of the staff members who were at the scene were given three-day or perhaps as long as a week leaves of absence. Several of the guards received no discipline of any kind, and the nurse who injected a corpse was given a promotional transfer to another state agency.
And I am very critical of Mr. Armstrong for his failure to take that incident seriously and his failure to train his staff when it became crystal clear that they had no conception of how to properly discipline and how to deal with mentally ill inmates. And I think that it's a particularly disturbing case because 7 months later, another paranoid schizophrenic young man in the custody of the Department of Correction was killed under extremely similar circumstances. His name was Bryant Wiseman. He was killed in a restraint and takedown asphyxiation type of incident, again on videotape. The videotape, which is very disturbing to watch, actually shows him dying. It shows the senior supervisor on the scene savagely beating Mr. Wiseman's body with at least 11 roundhouse punches, later described by that officer as a quote-unquote nerve compression technique. When that case was investigated, again, the same pattern that we saw in Tim Perry's case, no discipline, no remedial measures, no retraining, no findings of misconduct, no accountability.
Ultimately, John Armstrong, the former director of the Department of Corrections of Connecticut, left and joined this private corrections company, Management and Training Corporation, and went to Iraq. Your response?
Actually, he wasn't part of MTC, but he did go to Iraq. He was appointed by the DOJ to go over there and has been, his title is Assistant Director of Operations in Iraq. I mean, it's a very disturbing turn of events. It's hard to imagine that people at the DOJ and John Ashcroft in particular didn't know about Mr. Armstrong's background. I agree with the comments made earlier. I mean, either they didn't know and failed to do their homework, which is certainly plausible given how we've been running our post-war occupation over there, or they knew and thought that this sort of correctional philosophy was consistent with the kind of message that we want to send over there. And in either case, it's very disturbing.
Dan Frosch, we're going to end with you, and we only have 30 seconds, but I do want to get in Arizona. Can you talk very briefly about Terry Stewart, the former director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, who also went to Iraq?
Sure. Mr. Stewart was a longtime Arizona DOC veteran, and I believe he was appointed as director of the DOC in about 1995. That same year, the Department of Justice began an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct and abuse and rape on the part of guards regarding a Arizona women's prison, released their findings, concluding that indeed this misconduct was happening at a very disturbing level, and that DOC officials were not doing anything about it. And Stewart, much like Armstrong and McCotter in his defense of the use of the chair, and Armstrong in his reaction to some of the abuses we've just heard about, Stewart wrote a letter to then Attorney General Janet Reno saying, essentially, this hasn't happened.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Dan Frosch, independent journalist from New York. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.